You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody. Bill, we are fresh off of birthday week. How did it go?
It was a lower key birthday week. It wasn't the full smorgasbord of activities that it usually is, but I did have ice cream, my favorite ice cream place, Harold's, and barbecue, the best barbecue in the area, local Bergie. They have one thing that I don't think I've seen anywhere else. They do pulled pork and brisket. But they also do pulled pork, cheese curd French fries, and brisket, barbecue brisket, cheese curd French fries. So local Bergie is a seasonal roadside stand, but they have a standalone restaurant downtown, which is local burger. So you go to local burger, you can get poutine, fries with cheese curds and gravy. But you go to the barbecue stand, you can get essentially you can go barbecue style poutine, but it's not gravy, it's with, you know, different barbecue sauces. And that is really phenomenal. I can't even any place elsewhere I've seen it. So you had
barbecue, you had ice cream.
I mean, that's really and I did get to go by myself to the annual League of Women Voters Used Book Sale, which is really one of the stronger book sales. Almost everything is $1 or $2. So I got Team of Rivals. I got a Susan B. Anthony biography. I got Frederick Douglass and Anna Costia. I got the verbatim records, the first volume of the verbatim records of the Constitutional Convention. So I got a good haul for, you know, less than $10.
Very cool. Well, Bill, I feel like there's a, you know, we could dredge up, like, what did J.D. Vance say on Tucker Carlson this week? There's a lot of things.
Well, I don't even know what he said on Tucker Carlson this week.
We could honestly, talk out of mind. About. But I feel like there is one issue that we have to talk about, and it's not just your birthday. It's what is what's going to happen with this, the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the reconciliation bill? Like, this is crazy.
I mean, we're taping Thursday morning. We're taping September 30th, about 10 a.m. So, you know, we're definitely – this is when we hate to tape, you know, right before crunch time, because things are going to happen, you know, tonight that we can't totally know. But as far as what we do know at the moment, Pelosi has – I just saw this morning that she's still planning to have the vote, but it's but she operates hour by hour. There's other reporting saying that people expect the vote will be delayed because the votes aren't there and Pelosi isn't like bringing votes to the floor and the votes aren't there. Some of the House mods are saying, we don't care. Bring it to the floor. You promised us a vote. And I saw one of the nine moderates who crafted this deal in the first place say, if you delay this vote a second time this week, that's gonna be a breach of trust and it'll be catastrophic.
Right, because it was supposed to be Monday, right?
I mean, the House rule they agreed upon said the consideration would be on the 27th. You know, and so technically speaking, consideration is not the vote itself. So I think we're still in the period of consideration. But also Pelosi herself said over the weekend that we need to have these votes by September 30th because the Highway Trust Fund is going to expire. We don't want that expiration to lapse. Now other people say, well, you could pass a stopgap to keep that going. But that wasn't in the other bill to keep the broader government open, the so-called continuing resolution. They kept the Highway Trust Fund piece out of that. Maybe it gets tucked in at the last minute or it gets there's a stopgap separately. But it seemed like at the front end of the week that Pelosi was trying to force the issue and get this done now. But in the intervening time, we haven't seen Pelosi whip. We haven't seen Biden whip. You know, they're not whipping the other direction. They're just kind of being hands off.
Yeah.
And the general emphasis seems to be trying to get Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema to say something, to come forth with some kind of at least informal agreement to signal to the House progressives, hey, we're going to get reconciliation done. If maybe we can't cross every T and have like an entire bill laid out for you, but maybe there'd be a top line. Maybe there'd be the elements that we'd agreed upon.
Didn't Manchin say like $1.5 trillion?
Well, Manchin said a whole lot of things. I don't think Manchin has said he's firmly at the number. He's saying he won't do 3.5, but he won't say what he will do. But Manchin has been really, there's always complaining that they're not being clear. And in many respects, they're not. But I think one thing Manchin has been consistent on is saying he wants to engineer this from the bottom up revenue-wise. Let us agree on what tax increases and changes we're going to do and let that dictate the number. In fact, what he said, I believe yesterday, you know, days blur together, I think it was yesterday, he seemed to be suggesting, let's just do the tax reform in reconciliation. Let's do that and see where that comes out and then take the next steps after that. I mean, that's at least how I interpreted what he said. I mean, and whether he means that so fervently or it's just like one of the many things he says to confuse people.
That is the common theme here, is that nobody can speak clearly or say what the bottom line is. And I mean, ultimately, I think Joe Biden as the president is the primary problem. And this goes back to that day when he stood on stage with bipartisan senators who had just crafted what should have been a major accomplishment for him and said he's not going to sign the bill unless he also signs at the same time the reconciliation bill. Like, and then he sort of walked it back, but never really clarified. It was always confusing. He has never said, this is what we're doing, this is my agenda, and everyone needs to get in line with that.
Well,
he's sort of waiting for other people to decide what's going to happen rather than taking a leadership role.
Well, let's just separate these two things, though, because there's Biden's lack of clarity on his preferred sequencing. I mean, we know what Biden wants. He wants both bills, but he hasn't been very firm about, okay, are they linked or do we do them one at a time? That he's been more cryptic about.
But that's the whole ballgame.
But there's also the Manchin Sinema complaint largely from the progressives that you won't tell us what you are for, which, you know, they're sort of treating it like it's a moral failing on their part. They're not being clear. Whereas I'm more inclined to say, well, let's think about why they're choosing to do that. There obviously must be a reason why they're not doing that. And I think some people have, I think, made the wrongly implied that Sinema is not telling anybody what she wants, even privately. And again, I can't know what's going on privately, but what reporting we've seen is that she's having genuine discussions with White House staff about what she does want. So I think there's bona fide substantive private negotiation going on.
Don't you think what Sinema and Manchin really want is to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill first?
Well, they've said that.
And then
I mean, they are clear about.
Right, but I think they're being like strategically ambiguous. I think if Manchin and Sinema say, okay, we want $1.5 trillion, then we're willing to give that much, right? I think that makes it more likely that they would pass in tandem as opposed to the bipartisan bill passing first. So I think that they're being strategically coy about that. Whereas Biden, the buck stops there. He is the leader. It's his responsibility to cast a vision and provide clarity. And so I hold him more accountable.
I mean, I said when the August deal was done, which just on its face was a delinkage proposition that they will have a fixed date for bipartisan infrastructure and no fixed date for reconciliation, that create an incentive for moderates to not rush the reconciliation process, to take their time and negotiate and take it past the 27th, which has happened. Now, progressives...
But even the Pelosi deal was confusing. It wasn't... Both sides declared victory. Both sides...
Well...
And it wasn't because it was a win-win. They both thought they won because they both interpreted it in their advantage.
Well, progressives at least said, we haven't agreed to pass this on this date. Our position remains the same. And you should proceed accordingly, knowing that fact. I mean, that's the message they put out. And so what I find perplexing is to have Pelosi put a marker down this weekend, say, we're going to do this on the 30th, and then not follow up with whipping. I mean, what, you know, on one hand, we may reach a point today where progressives are going to win the day and not have this bill pass because they wouldn't provide the votes for it, leading Pelosi to not even put it on the floor. But we're not seeing the alternative timeline of what would have happened if Pelosi made her statement on Sunday, followed by whipping, with Biden calling all these progressive members saying, guys, you know, we need a win here. You know, we've had a terrible 2 months. We're in the 40s. We're all going to go down. Let's just start putting some points on the board. You got to have some faith in Sinema and Manchin that they're going to give us, you know, something and not have this be mutually assured destruction. This is my presidency on the line. Like, that didn't happen. So,
well, and in fact, there was the Axios story where Biden, somebody in Biden world is saying he won't beg. Now, that was apropos of nothing. I'm not sure where that, you know, why that even came into, you know, question, but they're signaling perhaps that he's not, he's not going to people and being like, hey, this has to happen. Come on. What do we have to do to make this happen?
So at least not by this hour. Maybe it's only changes at 5 p.m., but we haven't seen that yet. And I saw on the, you know, Politico, Sam Stein had a newsletter out. He wasn't quoting anybody, but he was relaying that progressives saying, you know, they're not inclined to vote for it. And we have not been pressured by the White House, which is kind of a way of saying maybe things would be different if I was pressured by the White House. But Biden hasn't tested the proposition. I mean, clearly there's a hesitancy. I don't know whether it is fear that he would whip and lose, which would be damaging for his standing, or there's a hesitancy to win ugly. That maybe they could, you know, twist the arms, you know, to the breaking point and get it, but there would be a bad taste in people's mouth on the progressive side if they won that way. That would lead to recriminations afterwards, which would be bad for party unity. I assume it's one of those two things.
I don't think he has the option of caring about how it gets done. This is the NFL. I mean, he has to win at this point. You know, the niceties about it are icing on the cake. I mean, come on. He's got to do it. And I would say this. Biden never, if you go back to the 2020 primary, Biden survived the left. He never tamed the left. He just sort of he just ducked them and sort of got past it. He never actually confronted them. And I kind of feel like that might have taught him the wrong lesson. Like maybe he – at the time it seemed like a great thing for him that he was able to survive without having to confront the left. But I think he just kicked the can down the road, and I think he's still trying. But like outlasting them for 6 months is different than outlasting them for 4 years. I mean he needs to confront them.
I think that's half right. Because I do think there's been points of confrontation. I think there are points of confrontation in the primary, particularly around, you know, Medicare for All. Even in this year, you know, he hasn't budged on canceling student debt, which, you know, Schumer and Warren and Bernie have pushed him on. He won't budge there. So there are certain lines. But I don't think it means that Biden survived a party that is majority squad. I mean, we just had this Iron Dome vote where, you know, AOC scratched out, what, 8 votes? So it's not like she calls the tune in every respect. But you do have a louder, more aggressive faction. And again, we don't really know how many people are in that faction. We know the numbers that the Progressive Caucus Chair Jayapal is offering. We know that she's saying, I have 50, I have 60, depending on what, you know, when you get her, she keeps ticking the number up. But we still don't see the names of these people. I mean, obviously, the fact that we're not, you know, have a bullet tray into a vote today suggests that Pelosi and Biden think that she's not totally bluffing here. But we don't know how big the faction really is because we haven't forced the vote.
This just reminds me of, you know, in the Republican Party, how like the adults wouldn't stand up to Trump or MAGA. And they just thought, oh, we'll nuance it, or we'll play nice, or we'll outlast them, or there's only a few of them. They don't have a majority. And just we need I am so craving someone to stand up to these people on both sides. I mean, like a young Bill Clinton in his prime. Now, granted, it was a different world and all that, but like I could see a young Bill Clinton getting that righteous indignation and standing up to them and putting them in their place. Biden's not going to do that.
Well, I mean, so he hasn't on this yet. I mean, clearly the desire is to try to keep both factions happy. They're trying to have a consensus approach that doesn't lead to a faction feeling like they got elbowed. And I don't know if that's possible. I mean, one theory of the case is, and one that I largely agree with, is it's not in any faction's interest to kill both bills. To kill both bills is to leave Biden without almost any substantive legislative success, even including the biggest part of the American Rescue Plan, which was the expanded child tax credit and the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. They would expire at the end of this year if both things pass. You know, it would be a reversal of progress, not even just like a status quo. So your moderate swing district members get hurt by that. Your progressive members, maybe they'd be susceptible to primary challenges for, you know, burning everything to the ground. And almost would surely lose the majority by 2022. So there is mutual interest here, but I do think it requires something at the top to push on the system, push on one faction or another to say, look, we have to get to a conclusion here. If you're just playing leverage games forever, we're all going to go down.
I mean, it may not be in their interest, but I don't think it's their priority. I think that like the incentives are, you know, it's the whole like collective action tragedy of the commons problem that we saw on the right. I mean, yeah, maybe collectively they would all benefit if Biden's agenda did well, but like that's not their priority. They, you know, AOC and Ilhan Omar, I mean, being sort of on the extreme example, like they're playing a long game. They're young. They feel like caving to the establishment.
But that's
a precedent.
That gives it less
leverage over time. That really they think they should have had $6 trillion that they've already compromised. They've already given away half a loaf or whatever.
But I think that faction is a small faction. I mean, like AOC, Ilhan Omar, I don't believe they would care if they lost their seats. They have a very well-defined, strong ideological reason for being in the arena, and they're willing to push things to the breaking point. And if they suffer a backlash from moderate Democrats, primary Democrats, and they get ousted in the primary, they'll just go on and be progressive activists for some organization afterwards, and they'll be just fine with that. That's my opinion. I mean, I know they have said publicly.
I disagree. I think being in Congress is too good of a platform for their careers in the entertainment world.
Well, if that was the case, they would compromise more to keep their seats. They wouldn't go down in flames on an Iron Dome vote. I mean, AOC has a pretty healthy Jewish population in New York City, and she was willing to take that vote. I mean, she switched from no to president, but that doesn't really, you know, matter. She believes what she believes, and I think she's absolutely willing to lose that seat to take, you know, votes that she sees as principled. But I don't think that is the feeling for the vast majority of other Democrats. I think the vast majority would like to keep the majority. They'd like to legislate, and want to stick around. So I think I think most are more bendable than an AOC is.
I mean, I just see this as like part of a larger trend of, you know, the lack of adults, the lack of leadership, of, you know, people who are supposed to be in charge just placating bad actors and tolerating everything, hoping it'll kicking the can down the road, hoping it'll work out in the end if we're just nice to people. And, you know,
it's not like, but it's like you want to see these bills pass. Won't you be happy if these all go down in flames?
I certainly think you can look at it if you are a conservative, that this spending, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I think you can make an argument for, the $3.5 trillion, I certainly would not support. So from a political standpoint, yeah, but if you see this as like a proxy for a larger struggle between, adults, like what I would really like to see is for Joe Biden to say, we're going to pass the bipartisan bill, and we're not passing this other $3.5 trillion bill
at all.
No, that's what you're asking me. What I want to see. That it's not going to happen,
right?
But that's what I would like to see. I've been very hard on Joe Biden, but it's not because I'm out to be hard on Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. Like I wish that Joe Biden would do what I want him to do, but mm-hmm. then he doesn't want to cooperate with that bill,
right? Well, I want to circle back a little bit to talk about the Sinema Manchin strategy. Because I feel like they're getting. I can't know exactly what they're up to, so I'm not claiming to be the Manchin Sinema whisperer. But I do think they're getting mischaracterized in certain respects. You know, I was having a lot of back and forth on Twitter yesterday. You know, where you know Manchin said there never was a deal that we would pass these at the same time. Everyone's like, what? What are you talking about? I'm like, that's actually just a plain fact. To try to find some point in time where Manchin said, yep, I'm linking these two bills. We are all for that. And then move the goalposts. Like that literally never happened. I mean, the closest thing that people can say is at one point in June, he said we should have a two-track strategy. But that two tracks means they're two separate tracks. Doesn't mean to link them as that one track, really. Well, see, it's possible for two tracks to arrive at the station at the same time, but that's not guaranteed. And McMansion said explicitly, I am not giving you a guarantee on reconciliation. He said that in August, just 9 days before the Senate passed the infrastructure bill. He said back in earlier in June that these should be considered on their own merits. And then people said, well, there was an assumption that people definitely had that impression and there was the appearance that I'm like, well, that is not a deal. That is not what actually happened. That's why you read what people actually say and don't assume things. And there's also this characterization going on that like Sinema's not telling anybody anything about what she wants, which I think like people should understand. Like there are lots of people in the world that negotiate in private and not in public. And
actually, it's more effective, generally speaking.
Well, this is the other point. Why is Sinema being so quiet publicly? Why does Joe Manchin speak an utter word salad all the time? By being inscrutable, you're in the game. Everyone's trying to find out what they want. And frankly, I mean, and this is saying one of the reasons why I'm a little confused about what's happening right now. But I do think that over the course of this week, like you're not seeing progressives putting out a hard line as to what should be in the bill right now. There's a hard line saying we're not going to pass the infrastructure bill as it stands. But they haven't said Joe Manchin needs to come out with $3.5 trillion and we're out. They haven't said that. They're basically begging them to say, just tell us something. Tell us what you want. And it would seem to me to create a dynamic where we could have had Sinema and Manchin come out like at midnight saying, okay, here's what we want. Pass the infrastructure bill now. And have Pelosi and Biden, you know, go into hardcore whip mode saying, okay, they gave us what they wanted. Boom, 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 boom. And before progressives could say, whoa, wait a second. I don't even like what they said. You know, I think they were not in a position to hold the line on the particulars because they weren't talking about the particulars for the past week or so. But Cinnamon Mansion, in my opinion, didn't exploit that opportunity. And in fact, they seem to be operating separately between the two of them. You know, Manchin's throwing all this other random stuff. We should do tax reform only, and we're going to have to stick to the Hyde Amendment. Whereas Cinema is doing her own thing quietly with the White House, and we don't even know what's going on there. So you're not seeing the various moving parts complement each other right now. It's all very disparate, unless like magically comes together at the end of the day, which I'm not predicting. But I felt Pelosi kind of queued things up for them on Sunday, and people on the moderate side didn't take the cue.
Let me ask you this. So let's say it goes sort of down in flames, like Pelosi has to pull the vote, doesn't vote on the bipartisan bill. What happens then? Like, I assume that it's not over. They could bring this up later and try to do it again. They have to pass the highway fund bill or whatever, but they could do that. Like, how important is it that they do it now versus a month from now?
I mean, there's two elements here. One is, are we linking or not? And if they're linking it, you know, there's the leverage question: who gets the upper hand in the negotiation reconciliation if they're effectively linked? And what's that vote count going to be for the infrastructure part in the House? Because you can't easily fold in the infrastructure piece into reconciliation. I think there's parts of it that wouldn't be reconciliation eligible, particularly on the Highway Trust Fund, because it's the policy more than just budgetary.
So you're saying when you say link it, you're saying that literally they could put it all into one.
I'm saying they can't. I'm saying they can't do that. But you may get to a point where you won't get any Republican votes for it in the House, which, you know, if every Democrat vote for it, you wouldn't need to. But it would be less of a bipartisan success. I don't think you'd see Mitch McConnell come to the signing ceremony if it happened that way, even though McConnell voted for the Senate version of it. And some Democrats might have preferred there be a standalone bipartisan signing ceremony to say, look at this bipartisan thing that I did. That would probably be out the window. And while progressive swing would have a higher degree of leverage in that circumstance, I don't think it means moderates lost leverage, because Manchin and Sinema and others could still, you know, Manchin and Sinema as individuals can still hold something up. So it'd still be a tense negotiation.
What about the deal? I mean, Pelosi said, we're going to vote on this on September 27th, or we're going to consider, or whatever. Like, would people feel betrayed enough to change their votes or to put their feet down?
You have moderates who have, you know, Sinema has said flat out, I won't vote for reconciliation if you don't pass this now. Whether she means it or not, you know, it was up to you to decide, but she has said that. And I saw a House member, a moderate, say, it would be a catastrophe if we got it postponed again. Didn't flat out say we will kill reconciliation, but that threat is looming in the air. Again, I don't think it's in their interest to do that, but they're putting enough of that vibe out there. I mean, there's certainly progressives that believe they want to kill it. they don't trust them at all. And so
I will shoot this puppy if you don't pass.
To the extent that you believe they want to kill it, well, that gives them about a degree of leverage. If you're willing to walk away credibly, you have leverage to shape things. So that's why I think moderates will retain leverage one way or the other. Now, we could still perhaps see some delinkage where some tentative agreement is made on reconciliation, but it's not every last line in the bill. And progressives say, fine. We'll do infrastructure now. And then negotiation continues a reconciliation. And so maybe that retains the bipartisan sheen of the infrastructure bill. Or not. Maybe Republicans can say, look, this is still too close together for my taste. So there's still, I think there's still some uncertainty how things get structured, even if this deadline gets blown, although you're certainly looking at a higher degree, higher probability of more overt linkage if it does get blown.
Bill, did you see my interview with Glenn Greenwald?
I didn't. I will let you talk about it, but I want to say one more infrastructure-related thing. There isn't any kind of hard deadline. I mean, this all has to happen. Again, one, if you can extend highway trust fund through a stopgap, which, mind you, would require Republican votes in the Senate to do. They can't do that on a party line vote. You mean Republicans don't care enough to take the ownership of throttling it by themselves in the Senate, but you do need 60 to do that. If they got that done, the only other hard deadline that's out there is the deadline to extend the expanded child tax credit and the enhanced Affordable Care Act subsidies. Those expire at the end of the year, December 31. These are signature legacy items for Biden right now. And so if those checks get cut off, you know, that hurts Biden and hurts perhaps a broad swath of Democrats. Having said that, there was a story on, I think it was CNN yesterday, saying some Democrats are talking about taking the child tax credit out of reconciliation entirely, which would be, you know, I would think to be a very risky move, because it's been sold so much as like, you know, we've cut child poverty by 45%. This is one of the greatest things we've done, you know, this year. I mean, the problem is it's a very expensive line item. It's $100 billion a year through 2026, I believe. If you went beyond that, it becomes even more expensive. It almost becomes $200 billion a year because Trump had a tax credit increase, a child tax credit increase that expires. So from a budgetary standpoint, if you got to fill in the gap of that tax credit expiring, that costs you more money. So chances are wouldn't be a permanent extension anyway. It'd probably be, you know, anywhere from 1 year to 5 years. But what the moderates have been saying all along is we don't want to do short-term extensions because that's budget gimmickry. We know these things cost more money and you're just faking it by making it a 1 year or 2 year thing. If it had to be in at a longer time frame, that, you know, the 5 years, that's $500 billion. And maybe that top line is coming down from $3.5 trillion to $2.5 trillion. Now that one thing is one-fifth of the entire bill, that makes it hard to do other things. So if you bit the bullet and just took it out, you could do a bunch of other stuff. And on top of all that, as I wrote a month or so ago, child tax credit, long-term extension, or at least permanent extension, doesn't poll that well. Democrats thought this would be such a political winner that it would be a slam dunk. It polls well as a temporary measure, as a crisis measure. It's not polling well as a long-term measure.
Is it – correct me if I'm wrong, Bill. This changes the Clinton model where you had to work to be eligible.
There's no work requirement, and Manchin has talked about trying to modify it in that way. It's refundable, so you get it whether or not you owe net taxes or not. And the delivery mechanism was changed that the checks are being – your credit is being forwarded to you over the course of the year. Right. You don't wait till the end of the year to claim it on your form.
I mean, I can see the argument for having a work requirement, which may sound harsh, but, you know, theoretically you don't want to incentivize having out of wedlock births in order to make – more money from the government.
Well,
right?
There's a social conservative argument that you should be incentivizing people staying home and taking care of their kids and not forcing them.
And not getting divorced either, too, and staying together as well, right?
I mean, I know that there's that kind of argument. I don't think a lot of progressives embrace that piece of it. But I think there's a certain progressive dovetailing of if someone wants to stay home with their child, you should give them the means to be able to do that. And don't praise people staying home from work if they have means and force and say, well, if you're poor, you don't get that choice.
But I assume this debate, which I think is very interesting, has nothing to do with the public not supporting this policy, right? I mean, I can't imagine the average person is
involved
at this level.
I agree with that. What I would gather is the case, and look, there's an argument that, you know, issue polling is a fraud business, period. Because no one thinks about these things at such a high level, except unless you're in the business. But as far as the gut reaction is concerned, my guess is all the stuff of the rescue plan was sold as crisis measures. It was never sold as we're changing the social contract about how we're going to deal with child poverty and how we're going to help middle-class families raise their kids. No one did a big push on that. There was an assumption on the Democrats' part that the checks will come in the mail and people will like them and we're done here. Obvious political winner. You know, just the mere fact that Biden's at 45%, give or take, is evidence that that's not the case. It hasn't magically enhanced his standing. I'm not saying his numbers went down because of that. They went down for other things, but they're not a bulwark against other problems besetting Biden. So that makes it harder to keep it in because there isn't an obvious political need to keep it in. I would argue it should be kept in some way. Because I think it's better to have legacy items and not to have legacy items beyond the fact that it seems to be actually helping people. But I think that's why it's become a bit more of a precarious question because of all these other political factors and fiscal factors.
Since you mentioned Biden's other problems, you know, one thing that happened this week, right, was you had these hearings where, you know, high-ranking military officials said that they – told Joe Biden they wanted to keep like 2,500 troops in Afghanistan. And Biden that contradicts what Biden had told George Stephanopoulos. So it's just like one more example of Biden either not remembering something really important, which is arguably scarier than what I think it is, which is him prevaricating again.
Or creatively spinning. I've seen the headlines. We probably need some kind of real TikTok to know like who said what to whom and when to be able to fully sort all out. Obviously, on its face, it looks bad for Biden. I still don't believe it's the thing that most people are paying attention to. Because Afghanistan as, you know, a matter of people's interest, I think, has faded. There hasn't been a flare up. There hasn't been Americans killed. There hasn't been a terrorist attack, you know, launched on our soil. So I still think it's become a bit of it remains an inside baseball question. But although I would not be surprised to see Republicans pulling the thread and trying to, you know, get Biden attacked as someone who's not being honest.
Yeah, I think that that's the problem is that it speaks to, you know, Afghanistan involves things like competence, like compassion. We're also seeing that on the border, competence and compassion tested with the Haitian refugees or migrants. But Afghanistan, we call into question his competence, his compassion, and also his honesty. These are all things that were, you know, the Biden brand. And so I think it's very damaging to him, not specifically because people care about Afghanistan, but because it undermines his brand identity.
So we're at 10:48 in the morning on Thursday. I'm just seeing on Twitter a 2-minute warning for a Pelosi press conference. So we should still keep talking, but I will be distracted and looking at it, seeing if anything, you know, crops in here.
Well, let's jump soon. I want to watch it because I'm actually writing a column for the Daily Beast about this topic.
I do want to hear about your interview with Glenn Greenwald because there is no way I will listen to your interview with Glenn Greenwald. I cannot waste that much time of my life hearing Glenn Greenwald's voice, but I'm happy to get your take on it and tease it for others who have stronger stomachs than I.
Okay. Well, first, go to youtube.com/Matt Lewis and watch it and subscribe. We talked for over an hour. I think it was a friendly conversation. I tried to challenge him and push him just so I could better understand his, you know, because I'm like, how did he go from being like perceived as someone on the left to now someone who goes on Fox News and like, you know, seemingly doesn't find Donald Trump as problematic as he found George W. Bush. Like, that seems weird to me. Mm-hmm. Like, from my standpoint, we had these decent, honorable Republicans that Glenn hated. And now we got this scoundrel that he doesn't mind so much, you know? So I just asked him that. And I thought he had he's a smart guy. I thought he had very smart, cogent answers to those things, which you may or may not buy. But he did have eloquent and plausible.
My basic view of Glenn Greenwald is that he has a certain worldview of extreme civil libertarian belief that, you know, there's an international new world order that is successfully militaristic and invasive in our privacy. And Trump was more in line of his foreign policy thinking than Bush or Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama was. Even though I'm sure he'd say, well, I disagree with Trump on this or Trump on that. You know, he did a drone thing. I didn't like that drone thing. But I'm sure he feels that in the main, Trump was more his kind of guy, foreign policy wise, than anybody else who's ever been president of the United States in his lifetime.
I think you're right. And I think that speaks to the fact that he actually does have a worldview that is consistent in that regard. The one thing, Bill, you know, I asked him, and this is a video. If you just want to watch like a 2-minute clip, I put this up on Twitter, the video, but
that's 2 minutes. I can't get back.
I pressed him on Trump, and he basically said, like, look, if I thought Trump could actually do the things Trump wanted to do, I would be super afraid of Trump. But – and this is Glenn speaking – but he knew that American institutions and the deep state would provide a check on Trump.
That feels more disingenuous to me. Here's a guy who's agitating for these institutions to be eroded. And now he's saying, well, I'm okay with Trump because at least they get to stick around and be a check on things. But he doesn't want to be a check on things.
See, that's what, you know, and I think that's the interesting conversation. And I've seen other people give that same pushback. My argument is like, well, maybe Glenn had more faith in American institutions than I have. Like, if I know that someone would become a dictator given the chance, I don't want to assume that the guardrails are going to inhibit them or prevent them.
Well, here's my thing about Greenwald. I mean, I think he has beliefs, sincerely held beliefs. But then once he stakes out that ground, he will backward engineer all sorts of random arguments that are not intellectually honest to hold that position, that sincerely held position. I think this is a bit of a digression. I don't know if you talked about it or not. He clearly holds MSNBC media figures or other media figures to a wholly different standard than he holds Tucker Carlson. Tucker Carlson says outright racist things. I know he's a friend of yours, so you don't have to nod when I say if you don't want to, but.
This is the problem with video, let me just say. Yeah. It's that when I'm talking to people, I nod, and sometimes if I'm interviewing them, I do it because I want them to keep talking. Mm-hmm. And the problem with the video, as opposed to being a print reporter, is it could be perceived that you're like agreeing with the other person when you're doing that.
But I think he clearly goes extraordinarily light on Tucker Carlson. I don't know if he's ever criticized Tucker Carlson for anything, quite frankly. If he has, feel free to show me. But he likes being on Tucker Carlson. And I think he said as much publicly that it's a useful platform for him. And he gets to say what he wants to say on it. And so he doesn't criticize Tucker Carlson for the most absolutely abhorrent things. Whereas any ticky-tack thing, like he was going nuts on Rachel Maddow because she tweeted out a news article about, you know, hospital crowding because of, you know, this horse medication thingamajig. The story proved to be wrong, and Rachel didn't correct the tweet until, like, you know, 48, 72 hours later. And so in the interim, like, when it wasn't corrected within 6 hours, Greenwald was on a tear that Rachel Maddow is, like, the most unethical, dishonest media figure. How dare she do this? And it's like – I even said, like, it's the weekend. I'm sure she's, like, out having a life and not, like, staying on Twitter. And she eventually got there. I mean, but the initial mistake wasn't hers. You can't fault somebody. You're quoting a news article and sharing it because you assume the news article is true. Yeah. And once you find that it's not true, then you correct it. That's not evidence of bad behavior. But he is ready to pounce for anything like that when it's MSNBC, particularly MSNBC. Maybe we've also seen that in New York Times or whatnot. I don't follow him that closely, but I know he's got animus towards MSNBC figures that he just clearly does not share with Tucker Carlson, because there are things he wants to promote, beliefs that he holds that Tucker helps him with. And so he is willing to be intellectually consistent in other areas to be able to have that platform. That is my interpretation of Glenn Greenwald.
I did ask him about it, and you can watch it to get the answer for what he said.
Oh, but you're trying to make me watch it now.
Well, let me say this. It's interesting. Your criticism of him is that he has beliefs, but then he reverse engineers, you know, ad hoc. And you know what that reminds me of is a criticism I've heard of Hugh Hewitt on the right. Mm-hmm. And it may be a lawyer thing, because, I mean, there are a lot of lawyers in this business, but they are both lawyers. And it may be, you know, when you're a lawyer, you sign on with a client. And once you're there, once they're your client, you will defend them. Like, that is your job, right? And there may be something to that.
Well, I mean Glenn is a lawyer, and he prosecutes his case very, very aggressively. In a way that well, you would in a courtroom. You throw everything at the wall you can throw at it, and you try to win, you know, not just through the substance of your argument, but by the force of your personality and the determination and the other, you know, courtroom theatrics and so on and so forth. Which is also the other point to, you know, his disingenuousness. I saw from the tweeting that he was trying to, his reaction post interview. This shows how we could be so much more civil if we just, you know, get out of our ideological boxes and have more conversations. I'm like, nobody is more uncivil and more personally obnoxious to his critics on Twitter than Glenn Greenwald. He's a paragon of incivility. So to hold forth now as like, oh, let's all just kumbaya and have a nice civil conversation together is like the pinnacle of phoniness.
I mean, I will say, now look, my podcast and my personality and my podcast is not confrontational. So Glenn probably knew he wasn't going into the lion's den where I was going to like, this is not Jamie Weinstein. By the way, my friend Jamie Weinstein, if you ever do his podcast, gird your loins, that, you know, be ready because he's coming at you. He's also a very nice, friendly, great guy, but he's tough. He's a tough interviewer. You know, I try to like have a conversation with people. So maybe Glenn knew that it wasn't going to be contentious. Having said that, I do applaud him for coming on my show. He didn't have to do that. He came on and we had talked for over an hour, and I did asked him challenging questions, and you know, I give him credit for being willing to do that. Likewise, Rod Dreher, who I disagree with, he's on the right. You know, he has given up on liberal democracy and is a defender of Viktor Orban. And Rod Dreher came on, and we had a long discussion. And I do think that's healthy for democracy.
The Pelosi conference has started. I'm sure you want to listen to it, but just to quickly, she's saying, today we are proceeding in a very positive way to bring up the bill, the BIF. I'm really annoyed they're saying BIF. It should be BIB. It's not a framework. It's a bill. Bipartisan infrastructure bill. Remove all doubt in anyone's mind that we'll not have a reconciliation bill. Here, this is a full quote. I just told members of my leadership that the reconciliation bill was a culmination of my service in Congress. Remove all doubt in anyone's mind that we will not have reconciliation. We will have a reconciliation bill. That is for sure. And as far as the infrastructure bill is concerned, so far, so good. So she's still remaining upbeat that all is going to get done.
We don't really know anything that we didn't know.
Well, she's not pulling the plug on anything as of yet.
Yeah, but I mean, come on, it's 11 a.m. Eastern time.
I mean, I can't say I know, like, how many hours do you need to execute a good whip operation? or if it's going to start anytime soon.
Here's the real concern, Bill, is that this is going to mess up my column, that I'm going to end up being up late waiting to see if they have some midnight vote or something. That's the catastrophe. That's the real catastrophe right there.
A little more quoted. We will have a reconciliation bill, that is for sure. Today the question is about we are proceeding in a very positive way to bring up the bill of the BIF to do so in a way that can win. And so far, so good for today.
Yeah. All right. I guess that's a good show. We don't know what's going to happen. But do check out the Glenn Greenwald interview on YouTube, and watch it twice, since I can't get Bill to watch it once. So.
I'll do a lot for you, Matt, but I'm like Meatloaf. I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that.
And on that note, follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show.
Is this a DMZ? Are we DM Zooming or not?
I don't think this week.
Okay, I'll do a solo Zoom for those interested. I'll send out information later.
Do you want to plug anything else?
You know, I had a piece in the Monthly this week about the Republican problem solvers, that if they don't vote for the infrastructure bill, they will have ceded the right to call themselves problem solvers. And I find it ludicrous that they would throw away their reputation by voting against it.
They're in the problem causers.
Well, right. I mean, the caucus chairs said this is a good bill. This was in line with the bill that we proposed previously. It deserved a standalone vote. Let's get a standalone vote. If you don't vote for it, how can anybody take you seriously after that point? This is like, you're already a joke. This is your one chance to not be a joke. I mean, they literally created in their mission statement to be a block, to function as a block to prevent the extremes of the parties from dictating the terms of legislation. This is the chance to do that. If they don't do it, they literally have no point for existing. And after I wrote that piece, which is interesting, Third Way, which is a Democratic moderate group that, you know, progressives hate, they put out a statement telling the Republican problem solvers, you have to do this or else you lose the right to declare yourselves problem solvers. So there is some tension between Third Way and the Problem Solvers Caucus right now.
All right. Good stuff. Happy belated birthday again. Bill doesn't celebrate one day. It's a week. So we will have a good one, man. And we'll see you back here in the DMZ next week.
Next week. Take care.